Hello, everyone, and I am so excited to be on the show with you today. Hello, everyone, and good afternoon to everyone here in the United States and around the world. We apologize. We seem to be having some technical difficulties, and we'll be speaking with Blog Talk Radio. This is the second week in a row, so we do apologize for that. And without any further ado, we have an amazing show today. I am really excited to bring on my co-host shortly, but we will have Robin Crespo from IMG Activewear and also the CEO, founder, and executive director of Code Purple event. This is an amazing gentleman. He is an entrepreneur, a humanitarian. He's going to share his ups and downs as an entrepreneur and what it took for him to just not wait for anyone to tell him what to do, but through trial and tribulation, the differences other people have made in his life, he became a humanitarian and finding something that was a solution to malaria that even stopped mosquitoes from biting people in various countries where malaria is a problem and an epidemic. So without further ado, we're not going to give away the show yet. I am going to bring on Mr. Jay Logan.
Gail, how are you? Hi, Gail, how are you doing today?
I am doing wonderful, Jay. We definitely have to talk to Blog Talk Radio about these issues that we're having with the radio station here. But let's get beyond that and go right into the show. Are you ready, Mr. Logan, to do that?
I am so excited. Let's do it.
Yeah, and you know, Jay, I am so excited about Robin Crespo being on the show today. You know, it is just an amazing, it's just, you know, watching Robin from where he was and, you know, and he just keeps growing by leaps and bounds and the show that he's doing with the documentary, you know, we're going to get to talk with him about that. I'm just so, so excited, you know. So without further delay, Jay, I wanted to go into something that really is close to home, you know, around Robin today. And it's about a woman by the name, a legendary designer by the name of Vivian Westwood, okay? At her 2013 runway show that was in Milan Saturday, what stuck with audiences was her stunning collection for climate revolution, okay? She is 71 years old in the fashion industry, has an a really outspoken voice on environment and sustainable practices, and has been, you know, and she's been really outspoken in the fact that it's slow to adopt change given where we are with our climate right now, you know. And, you know, she's really looking at climate revolution as a means towards a sound economy, you know. And one of the things she said she inspired her collection by global warming and urban traveling, you know, biking in particular, all right. So she had these chiseled models strutting down the runway there in streetwear, tailored trousers and cashmere, you know, sweaters, okay, that were actually, you know, sporting some of these things that were made in Kenya. And, you know, and she's doing through trade and ethical fashion trade. And I'm so happy about this because here it is that we have Robin coming on who has created and invented a fabric that fights the mosquitoes from biting through for malaria and Lyme disease. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So this is amazing to see that there's another person here that, you know, I know was unbeknownst to me, that's in the fashion world that's walking the walk and talking the talk. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, if you catch it on, it's great that we have other entrepreneurs and people out there that are trying to do things to help the world and help other countries. And it's just great that she's out there doing the same thing. She's walking the walk and talking the talk.
You know, it really is, Jay, because if you think about it, you know, we're here dealing with mosquitoes, they're dealing with mosquitoes in other parts of the world, and it's getting worse as a result of climate control. You know what I mean? I mean, the winters look like the summers look like the winters. It's really getting a little crazy, to be quite frank with you, you know? So, you know, I'm just blown away that, you know, I happen to say, well, what will we talk about today? That's in relationship to what we're speaking about here, you know, with Robin, you know, and it's just amazing to see this and see what's going on. It's just unbelievable, you know. And that brings me to our next one. You know, did you hear? Now this is a completely different topic. It's kind of funny. I don't know. You know, have you heard, Jay? This is amazingly funny. I couldn't believe it. That Google, the CFO of Google, is saying that Facebook is doing a really bad job with its products. Now, I couldn't believe this. Okay? Now, you know, this for me is absolutely funny because it says, you know, they're saying that. Now, when asked about Google's motivations for competing with Facebook in the social networking space, he didn't mince words. He said they're a company that's strong in that space. He said that they're doing also a really bad job in their products. Now, how did you say this? When Google, you know, has been paid, you know, has been criticized as well. He's criticizing for being, you know, to Facebook for being closed with its data, you know. They should be closed with its data because it involves our data. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it really gets me. And both of them are behemoth corporations. You know, and he's saying that they don't need Facebook to fall with the company in order for it to succeed in social. He says, we're doing something different. But, you know, I think it's an outrageous to say that there's only space for one company in these areas, he says. So, you know, they're very happy with Google Plus. I don't think Google Plus is all that great, and they are trying, to me, to use somewhat of what Facebook has. You know, every company has to survive. I mean, what are your thoughts about this? Because I just thought it was kind of really funny for him to say that, you know, that it was in that way. What do you think about that, Jay?
That's very funny. Google is very competitive with Facebook. You know, they're actually out here in the Bay Area, so they're at odds all the time. Google has been very competitive with Facebook as well as with the Apple company out here. They're fighting, trying to find a niche, and not just to be a search engine. They're always working on new products, such as, you know, they want their own telephone. Facebook is growing and is taking a bigger share of the market. So it's probably like this is the only way Google can fight back. The CEO can fight back. I think Facebook is doing a great job, actually. I mean, if it wasn't for Facebook, a lot of people wouldn't actually be in communication with each other. I'm not into Google Plus that much, and they're trying to take a bigger share from Facebook.
So now, Jay, you and I would probably have a disagreement with that, and I don't want to – we have Robin here, so I don't want to keep it long, but I'm going to leave you with one thing. I'm, like, a little annoyed that Facebook is charging $1 to reach certain people in your network when you send a message. I think that's ridiculous because that allows spammers to send spam if they're willing to pay $1. You know, they're getting a little nuts, and they're turning off some of your feeds as well just because you don't talk to that person in 2 days. So you and I really – I mean, I love – Facebook, it's addictive, and I do love it, and I agree with you. You can talk with people that you normally can't talk with, like friends I have in other countries or friends you have. But they're, you know, they both have their pluses and minuses, I think, and this is definitely a conversation for another time. I love when we have a different opinion because, you know, we then can bring something to the table that allows our audiences to hear two sides. But, you know, Jay, guess who we have waiting to come online? You will not believe who we have.
Let me see. I think his name kind of starts off like a bird or something, but I think it's Robin Crespo.
Yes, I think it's Robin Crespo, too. So without further ado, we're going to bring on Robin Crespo.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Hi, Robin. I believe you remember Jay. How are you doing,
yes,
Jay?
Yes, Jay. How are you doing, Jay Logan? Doing well?
I'm doing well, and thanks for being on the show, Robin. It's good to hear from you.
You know, we're really excited about this year. This is going to be an unbelievable year. I'm really excited to be here today, so I thank you guys for inviting me on the show.
You have no idea how excited we are. We're excited that, you know, we're working together with you. Our song is getting ready to come out that's going to be supporting your organization. We are just so excited, Robin, about the work you're doing. I can actually contain myself. I'm not going to lie to you. You know?
The last couple of weeks I've been out on a back injury, so I've been a little bit quiet. And so I've gotten a lot of phone calls over the last couple of days on, you know, what are you guys doing? What's the next thing for for Code Purple. What are you guys doing? And over the last 2 weeks, I've really had some time to unknot the knots that were in my subconscious mind. And
if it's okay with you, we have some really fun questions for you today. We'd like to know if we can start getting into that interview with you. Would that be okay with you?
Yeah, let's jump into it.
Okay. Well, Robin, we learned some interesting things since our last interview with you. And many of our audience members don't know how you started, okay? Our first question for you today is, we want to go back a little bit and bring everyone to the front. Is that okay with you?
That's fine. We're going to go way back, though.
But we don't want to go too far back. Our first question to you is, would you share with us on how you got started in fashion, if you wouldn't mind?
The first time that I think that fashion struck me as a thought, as a concept, and when I actually knew that it was something that I wanted to do or be a part of, I was in first grade. It was the first day of school, and I was going to a new school. It was called Roberto Clemente School for Gifted and Talented Kids. And that day, I had on a brand new pair of white-on-white shell-top Adidas with white fat laces. I had a pair of skinny white jeans. They were Levi's. And I had a white Le Tigre shirt on. And I had lines on the side of my head that were shaved in. I had a long tail and a spiked haircut. And as we were driving, as my mother was driving me to the new school, we didn't have much growing up. And we grew up in the inner city. And actually, the back floor of her Volkswagen was rotten. You know, so, and it was a little wet out that day, and I remember holding my feet up because I didn't want them to get dirty and the splash from the drive. But it was when I stepped outside of that car that I realized that what I was wearing was, or was creating a new identity for myself, and I was able to separate myself from my current circumstances. And because it was a new school and it was the first day of school, I felt like a new person. And it was at that moment that I realized that clothing and fashion and what you're wearing and how you're wearing it could mean something. And it began at that moment in first grade. And, fast forward, I think I was maybe in third or fourth grade, I submitted for a competition to design a new sneaker. And I think the company at the time was Nike. And I lost the competition. And that... it devastated me in one way because I could not understand why I didn't win. I mean, I made a sneaker that, you know, it was a high-top sneaker that you can unzip and make it a low-top sneaker, and I just couldn't understand why I didn't win. And I think that is really where all of this began for me. So at a very young age, I mean, I found quickly the power behind fashion and identity, and then I think losing that sneaker competition created the drive in me to really pursue this something.
Wow.
That's the beginning.
Wow. Yeah, Robin, Robin, I wanted to ask you, we hear that you've worked with many amazing people and celebrities. Would you share how you got started in working with so many famous people? And what advice would you give students who would like to follow in your footsteps to do the same?
Fashion is, if I was to give advice to students, I'll take the second part of the question first, is to really look at the business in a circular view, a 360-degree view, because, you know, so many people go to school to be a fashion designer, to be the next big designer, and I think that the dream as a young child is, you know, I want to be a fashion designer. And I know a lot of kids that I talk to and a lot of parents that I speak to about this. But the one thing I would say is that there are so many supporting roles that are very, you know, you're very well paid for these supporting roles that actually can take someone within the fashion world or the fashion community. And I would encourage kids and parents to look beyond, the tip of the iceberg and look at some of the supporting roles, because there's an entire business that is tied to fashion, and there is a world that that people can go to school for in this community and really carve out for them a nice slice, a nice income, and you know, a nice slice of life. So I would encourage anyone that if they love fashion, find out, what portion of fashion, and, maybe they can't draw, I'm not the best sketch artist, but I work with a team of three people that are the best sketch artists. So, you may not have that one ability, or you may not be strong in that ability, but I wouldn't allow that to discourage you. I mean, if it's in your heart, that means that it was placed there by God. So I would pursue it. I would definitely pursue it. The second half of it is really about partnerships. And I've gotten the ability to be part of an organization called 5001 Flavors. And I was introduced to my partner, Guy Wood, back in 2006. And I was working on, and this is when I was developing a fully recycled plastic bottle fabric. And I was sick and tired of the bathing suits, with the floral prints on them, the Hawaii floral prints. I was really frustrated with that, and I sat down and I designed a new bathing suit collection, and I designed it alongside this fabric that would not get wet. And I was introduced to Guy, and we sat down, and I showed him my portfolio, and I showed him my concept, and when I showed him the fabric, it was immediate that we were going to partner, and it was immediate that we were going to connect. So from there, I was able to start working with Guy on the bathing suit collection, but then also being able to learn the business of fashion. And there were a lot of design sessions that I was able to get in on that most people, would only dream of. And it was through this partnership that I had the ability to work with so many great folks out there.
Wow. You know, Robin, did you have another question, Jay, or do you want me to go on?
I have some questions, but I want you to go on. I don't want to, all the wonderful questions we have, I don't want to take advantage of you. Go ahead.
Okay. So, Robin, having your business in fashion gave you a view of becoming a humanitarian to change the world, okay? And I would love for you to share with us, how this came about, and what had you look at the epidemic of malaria?
Yeah, the philanthropy side of things is something that, because I've thought about this over the last year so much. How did I get to this point? How did I become this person, or how did we get this far in? And I started to look at some of the things I was doing in back in 2005 and 2006, I actually had a finance company that I was working for, and I was able to spin off with a partner at the time. And my goal was to create a financial company where people could come in, get financing, and be able to trust the system. And the system would be set in a way that would not take advantage of people. So this is something that I think was inside or embedded into my character long before we got to the point that we're at now. And even with the bathing suit collection, one of the things that that we're working on is that the proceeds would go to teaching inner city kids how to swim, because I believe that swimming was or is something that's so important to life. And being able to participate in summer activities and not being afraid of water, and water could be dangerous. So there was always this drive to help others. Worked on another project called One Life, One Soul, where I would make designer jackets for clients, and then I would make a second jacket, and I would actually give it away to someone that was living on the streets as a homeless person. And watching the shift in them from, feeling unappreciated to getting something that was custom made, something that, was extremely expensive and valuable, and seeing that the message that you're just as important as the next person. So you know, being philanthropic, and I think the drive to help people has been there and has been embedded in me for a long time. And at this level with malaria, I think it's really the pursuit of truth. And over the last year, we found some interesting data that was not, or other than it's not public knowledge, but it's not the knowledge that is highlighted. So I think the pursuit of finding the truth behind malaria, to meeting malaria face to face, versus reading it over the internet or articles, and I wanted to meet malaria face to face, and I think the pursuit of truth, the ultimate goal to find the real truth behind malaria. I think our belief is that malaria is preventable. So if we can find that truth, then we can carry forward the preventative measures that we have in place. So, and what we were able to find, the truth that we were able to find with malaria when we spent time in Africa is that it is preventable. One of the problems is that it's socially acceptable. You know, to me, that's one of the identifying factors that would have to change. So one of the things that we're looking at is by using fashion, making malaria almost uncool, that it's not acceptable. And it's some simple things that you can do, you know, before you take a shower, before you use the bathroom, you know, stopping for a moment.
Robin, we have to give our guests sex.
Okay. Hello?
Yes.
That's very interesting, Robin. I'm seeing how you're changing the culture of a nation, which is very interesting when you said it was socially acceptable, because that's hard for me to believe that they just think that's the norm and that's just a normal thing. Changing the culture of a nation is such an extraordinary thing. What you're doing is getting people to think outside the box. I was wondering, when did you know this material that you designed would really make a difference? And, I mean, really, Robin, how did you know?
The reasons why I created the fabric were very selfish. You know, I wanted to be one of the only people at the party in the summer that, you know, was not being bitten by mosquitoes. But as I did my research, I realized how perverse the problem was with malaria and how many people were dying. And I think that, you know, although our test certificates said that our product worked, and we knew that our product worked. I mean, we knew that we knew the science behind it was sufficient, and there were plenty of case studies that supported what we believed that we created. But I think that the documentation was not good enough for me as an individual, and I needed to know firsthand if this product actually worked. So we made a decision to actually, you know, I spoke with my family, I spoke with my children, and I and everyone agreed that, and I'd asked them if it was okay with them if I would travel to Africa without taking any of the recommended medications, because if what we had was actually going to work, it had to work independent from medication, because in these areas that we were looking to work, in areas that we are working, preventative medication is not available, and you know, having a life or living a life in these areas dependent on medication alone, which we knew was not a sustainable measure to take against malaria. So it was after I came back from Africa and without taking any of the recommended medications, and I did not sustain one single bite. I was not bitten one time. We were in some of the most, we were in areas that were completely endemic with malaria, swampy areas, water areas, the bush, I knew at that moment that we had something that could actually become a major game changer in the fight against malaria, and that we would be able to piggyback on the success of the sleeping bed nets that that actually, you know, work very well and provide a level of protection between 6 to 8 hours as long as someone's sleeping under properly. We knew that now we can give mobility to the problem, and that it actually worked and that it would work outside of medication. And it was when I came back from the first trip in Africa that I knew I had something that would change the game.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
It really is. And, Robin, as you know, a lot of people know, including our audience, my mother passed away last year. And it has had a profound impact on what I plan to do with the world with my partner Jay here and my partner in London and our partner in Australia on what we want to do to change the world. And that's one of the reasons we reached out to you and other people who are making a difference in places like Africa and India and Haiti and other places. And I understand that your brother passed away. And I wanted to know. I'm sorry?
I said he did.
Yes, and I wanted to know, how does this affect what you do as a humanitarian?
You know, my brother passed away in 1998, and I was 19 at the time, and he and I were extremely close. We were only 20 months apart, and at the time, we were kind of in a disagreement, you know, a brotherly quarrel, I would call it. But he passed away, and it was sudden, and he was actually helping someone on the side of the road and was hit on the side of the road and thrown, 20 feet and was killed instantly. But his death brought on a very dark period in my life. I think that the insides of me died when my brother died. And when I say the insides, I mean my mind, my spirit, my desire to move forward. And I became a robot, and it was, and that's when I started to work in finance. I figured it was a good place for me to hide. I could make some money, and, no one would really bother me. And, so I would get up at 5:30 in the morning, and I would work till 9 o'clock at night, and I did that 7 days a week for 5 years straight. So it had a profound effect on me, but there was a day, and I'll never forget, I was driving to work, and instantly there was a shift inside of me, and the old me, the artist, the fun, that person came back, and it came back in an instant. And I remember looking down and wondering what I was wearing, because that's the very corporate clothing. I was like, whoa, what's going on here? Who are you? But that time in my brother's death, it affected me in ways that led me to some of the darkest places of my humanity. And in coming out of that, my desire to help other people, I don't know, is really based on my brother's death. But my desire to be who I am is based on what I experienced after my brother's death, because I shut everything off that was me. I shut off the artist. I shut off the creativity. I stopped drawing after he died. So in celebration of the life that he lived in that dark time, I try to focus as much as I can on my art and being as creative as possible and really relishing in that creativity, because it is who I am, and I think it's the reason and purpose of why I am. So I often reflect on his death and that time, and it's one of those things that I cherish, because it allows me to really realize that, who I am has a purpose and a reason, and shutting it all off or shutting it down, there's no benefit to that. So,
thank you.
It's been a while since someone asked me that question. I was prepared for that one. You said this was going to be fun, Dale.
Well, no, but you know what it is? I think that people need to understand that people like yourself and myself interact. You know, and Jay, you know, an award-winning producer. You're a well-known designer, and I'm a well-known consultant. And we interact with a lot of people, but there's a human side to us. We bleed, we cut, we go through things just like anyone else. And we have things that affect us. And I think it's very important for people to know, Robin, that you didn't become a humanitarian and an entrepreneur overnight. You know, that you're human and that you went through things that, you know, that anybody can go through and that they can still have their dream no matter what they go through, and that you will sometimes cut yourself off when things happen. It's very important that people know that, you know, people who become successful, you know, they too are human beings. You know, and for us, this show, Robin, is about connecting people to learn more about themselves as well as what they can do in the world and achieving their dreams and all of those things. But it's to let them know that they can also, and it's also to leave you as a guest empowered, you know, that knowing that we appreciate what you do and that you have a life and that you have lived a life as well, you know. And I think with that said, Jay has another question for you before I go on there.
I sure do, Robin. I wanted to know, what was your trip like to Africa? What bright energies did you bring back, and what smiles did you bring back after that trip?
Well, we have tons of video footage and pictures from that, which I think captured the lifestyle of some of the folks that that we were able to meet and connect with. But, you know, one of the things in the first trip that I distinctly remember, it was, we landed in Uganda, and I remember, I can distinctly remember the smell of, it reminded me of when I was a kid and I would go camping, because there was a lot of, it was almost a smell of burning wood in the air. And I remember that night particularly was, I was wearing mosquito armor for the first time, and I was wearing it in an environment where I could be bitten, and I knew that I was taking a risk and putting my life on the line for this. So I can kind of remember that feeling. And from that base camp, we traveled north to Gulu, and we stayed in a small village called the Dock. And one of the things that I remember, the first night that we stayed there, it got extremely dark when the sun went down. I mean, when I say dark, it was so dark that you could not even see your hand in front of your face. I mean, you could put your hand on your nose and you could not see your fingers moving. It was that dark. It got dark around 6:30, 7 o'clock. And when the sun went down, there's darkness. Now, of course, we had flashlights and things like that, but there were times where, you know, you would sit there and you'd have you're talking and you had the flashlights off. There's darkness that set in. There was a sense of fear that also set in alongside it, of helplessness that set in alongside it. But one of the most beautiful things happened, and I don't think I could have. I've never experienced this anywhere in the world. And, you know, we're in this remote village. There's no power, you know, so the only lights that you have are, you know, flashlights or fire. And we didn't have a fire the first night, and we only had our flashlights. The most interesting thing happened, and at around 9:30, or maybe it was a little bit earlier than that, maybe 8:45, the moon rose. And the moon rose as if the sun was rising, and it brought about this immense amount of light into the village, so much light that you felt, well, we weren't using flashlights, there was so much light, but you can see, you can move, you can talk, and it was so powerful, this amount of light that the moon brought in, and the overwhelming sense that that God did not or would not leave us in complete darkness set in. And I think that was one of the most powerful experiences that I experienced in Africa, was that we're not in this darkness alone. We're not in this world alone. And even though there are moments where, you know, and it was about 2 hours that it felt you know, this complete darkness. You couldn't even move around without a flashlight. When that moon came up, and as if the sun would, it brought about this sense of relief and this connection to the world, this connection to everything. And I think that that was probably one of the most beautiful experiences, and it kind of set the tone from that point of how well we were able to connect with individuals in Africa, because of that experience, there was a deeper sense of connectivity to everything, not just people, but to the world, to the environment, and that we're not alone.
Wow. Now, Robin, we're coming close to running out of time. We just have a few more questions for you. And, you know, I'd like to know, what was your trip like to Haiti, and what made you go there?
Haiti was a quick, it came up very quickly. A good friend of mine who runs an organization called the FAR Organization was building a church down there, and he asked me, Robin, please, you know, come with me to Haiti. It would be a couple of days, and we really want you to see Haiti and experience it. We traveled to the northern part of Haiti, a place called Cap Haitien, and Haiti was amazing in the sense that everything was moving. There were no still parts to Haiti. and it seemed like everybody was working and almost recycling everything. So nothing felt that it was going to waste. But I realized something in Haiti that, and it's funny that you asked me about Haiti because I was thinking about it today. There was no real recycling programs in Haiti. So there's an immense amount of plastic and waste in Haiti. And one of the things that I would like to do is be able to go back to Haiti and start a recycling program where plastic can be collected. And just like we have the recycling programs here, where 5 cents can be given for each plastic bottle. And I learned as I was there, I learned some research that, you know, plastic is a commodity that when it's broken down and recycled and returned back to, you know, these little pellets, it's worth money. And I found someone that was actually working in Haiti and actually had contracts to sell that plastic to China so that it can then be made into computers. So one of the things that I learned in Haiti is that, there was plastic everywhere. I mean, on the beach, there was plastic in the ocean. There was plastic everywhere. There were plastic bottles everywhere. That if we could put in place a recycling program where people were able to collect and get paid the 5 cents, I know that Haiti would have no plastic left because everybody, like I said, is moving, is working, is hustling. They're doing something to provide for that very day. And through the individual that I met, I know that we would be able to then take pay the 5 cents out, break down the plastic, and be able to sell that plastic to China, and ultimately, you know, turn that over to the Haitian people. So that was why I went to Haiti, and I went to Haiti because I was just invited to go because my Finney Matthew believed that if I went there, I would see something that, you know, I would be able to bring some sort of value. And what I saw was I saw money laying around everywhere in the form of plastic. And while I was there, I was able to connect with an individual who was building a recycling plant there, and his generator was not working. And we just happened to have a generator mechanic on our team who went and actually worked on their generator. And when I showed up at their plastic recycling facility, the generator was actually purple. And I took that as a sign, and it was pretty funny, but because they've got this thing with purple, with the code purple thing, and to see a purple generator in the middle of Haiti was pretty interesting. But so I've been working with Finney and this individual on putting together this recycling package, and hopefully we'll return to Haiti this year and be able to really push that and using the power of media and video to be able to promote it.
The room that you are working on a documentary, could you tell us a little bit about that, Robin?
The documentary that we've been filming is called Five on Monday, and it features five children, five countries who are diagnosed with malaria on Monday, who may not live to see Sunday. And we started with Uganda, and we met a 12-year-old girl by the name of Immaculate. And although our initial intention and what we wrote down on paper was to, follow the effects of malaria in a child from a Monday to a Sunday, in the first opening story and first country of the Five on Monday, I quickly found myself and the film team in the crosshairs of a decision of what we were going to do. Were we going to intervene or not? And there was a point in this initial portion of the film where I was completely overridden with frustration and anger that we were going to actually stop filming because it just seemed so wrong when you're faced with this issue. To move forward underneath the circumstances and in the pursuit of a story felt so wrong. And our team actually, and I, we sat down and I decided that we were going to intervene. We had to. It was our obligation to intervene. So we intervened, and it takes this initial opening story. It takes us so deep into this child's life and struggle with malaria. It's really amazing. But we have four more countries to film, and initially we thought this would be of an in and out quick process. But in pursuit of the truth, in pursuit of the real texture of what we do, we're realizing that the process is going to take a little bit longer, but it will be worth the wait. It will be worth the wait in every which way, because the story is so compelling and so emotional that everyone that watches a director's cut that we put together is so moved by it they want to help and they want to get involved. So I believe the project's going to take more time, maybe even a couple more years, but it is a story that needs to be told, and I believe it's the story of the truth behind malaria. And from everything we've done as far as research, there's nothing that has the texture, speed, and truth behind what we're telling in this story. So it's an exciting project. We're looking at possibly Nigeria. We're looking at Haiti. We're looking at Thailand as some of the other countries that we're looking at filming in 2013.
I want to ask you, how does what you learn as an entrepreneur, being a family man and a man of God, and experiencing life and death, plays a part in the difference that you make in the lives of others daily?
How does all of that make a difference in the lives of others? I think that the experience of life and death, facing life and death, my personal experiences with it, especially my children and my family, and then my relationship with God, I think all of it centers and really brings me to one singular point, which is, the first duty, which I believe is to love your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But then the very next and most important thing in the world is to love others as you love yourself. So loving your neighbor, I think, is the most important thing. And realizing that, my life or death, or anyone's life and death, that we're only here for a very brief moment. It's just a flicker. It's just a speck of dust in the grand scheme of time and things. that the only real thing that we get to leave is a legacy, and the only way that you can really leave that legacy is by leaving it in someone else's life, and the only way to truly leave that legacy in someone else's life is by being a real neighbor to them, by helping them when they're in need, by giving when it's hard to give, by loving them when maybe it's not the cool thing to do, or the you know, you may have every reason to hold the grudge, and forgiving them. I think that it's the pursuit of love, ultimately, that is driving this whole thing to make a difference in other people's lives. And I think that this really all comes from the relationships that I have with my children, my family, the relationship I had with my brother, the relationship I had with death, and the relationship ultimately that I have with my God. I think that those are the things, and the undertone and heartbeat behind it is love, and expressing that to the world, because I believe that we are all connected and we are all each other's neighbors. So making a difference in someone else's life is really the ultimate pursuit of love.
Big up. Wow. What an answer. That's wonderful. What was research and development like for your product? I mean, tell us a little about the research and development.
Research and development. We use a chemical which is very, very common. In fact, I can probably go into any household in the United States and find the residue of this chemical inside of that home. And sometimes this chemical, you can even find it on the fruits and the vegetables that are in the refrigerator. So the research and development came in by identifying a chemical that was safe and that had enough data, supporting data behind it. And that's where we started. And we identified a few different chemicals that fell into this category. But there was one in particular that had actually hit on every single area that we were looking for as identifying factors. And then the question was, were we going to be able to take this chemical and have it bond to a fabric? And, you know, my experience and my partnerships, we're partnered with a mill in Colombia. And this mill has worked with us since 2006 on developing fabrics. And I'm like a little kid when I go into any situation. I ask a lot of questions, a lot of redundant questions, and a lot of how come, why not, you know, why is the sky blue? I don't understand. Can we do this? Can we do that? And the understanding from the first fabric of how polymers work in creating synthetic fabrics, and the bonding agents that take place for that process to happen allowed us to be able to quickly come to a solution to use this chemical and get it to bond and adhere to our fabric, and then being able to take that process and being able to weave it into something that was lightweight, breathable, and perfect for hot weather environments. And then from that point, we left it up to the professionals after we created the fabric and developed it. We left it up to the professionals to test it. So we looked at a third party to test for the chemical and test for the durability of the chemical within the fabric. And they came back, and the results were really excited, because we found that even after 50 washes, our fabric on a per square inch was still 600 parts repellent, which was over the amount that was necessary. So we could have continued our testing, and we believe that our fiber probably would have lasted with the degradation of the chemical probably 75, maybe 80 washes. And again, initially, we didn't start this process with the intention of creating, you know, fabric that would fight, you know, disease and malaria. I mean, it really, that was not the beginning of this. It was very selfish reasons in the beginning. But again, committing to excellence, following through and getting down to the base or the beginning, which is ultimately the truth, which is the place where we design from, I think that all of those things came into play, which then took us into this place that we're at now, where we're looking to scale this up so that we can fight malaria head on. So the research and development really came through the partnerships that we have, and the and their willingness to work with me and go through the creative process and the 1,001 questions that I ask. And every time that they said, you know, I don't think that's possible, or no, that's not possible, I would then follow up with, how come, why not, have you ever done it, how do you know it's not possible? And I think like that Thomas Edison desire of, you know, finding the filamer that will light the light bulb, you know, and I think his response is classic. It's when he was asked, you know, how did it feel to fail, you know, 9,000 times. So I didn't fail 9,000 times. I learned what not, you know, what did not work. So I think that it's that pursuit of making it happen, and then challenging those that said it's not possible when they said that has led us to this point. You don't want to develop a fabric with me, believe me. We actually have two new fabrics that we're and I just got the first sample into yesterday, and it is a lightweight windbreaker material that we're looking to use for nautical application for divers and people that are, you know, in the Cayman Islands, or people that are in, you know, at sea, fishermen, fishing communities, in remote villages. It's a windbreaker style material that is also has some skin warmer technology in it. And the second fabric, which we should be finalizing in the next couple of weeks, will be our first camouflage fabric, which we're looking to provide to militaries around the world that are trying to keep communities safe, but are dealing with the risk of malaria.
Wow, that's wonderful. Robin, could you let people know where they can make a donation or buy the hoodies or even the new windbreakers from you?
Well, the windbreakers I just touched the fabric for the first time yesterday, and that we're a ways off on that one. But if you wanted to purchase the mosquito armor, you can go to ingactivewear.com, or you can go to codepurpleevent.com, and the product is carried there. And it's a pretty simple process. You know, you just go on, click your size, and it gets shipped over to you.
That's wonderful. I have one last question, and regarding WNV, West Nile virus, your organization is doing to combat this virus over here in the States?
You know, it's really interesting because we were filming in the fishing village of Lamboe when a news article was sent to me that there was a major West Nile outbreak, and I think it was 48 or 47 states where the West Nile virus had taken hold, and I believe Texas declared a state of emergency. And I think when we heard that, we were so, and I know this is going to sound horrible in one way, but it was never meant in that way. We were excited. Not that West Nile is, you know, in America or that people were dying from it, but excited that the problem was something that people could identify with at home, because we believe that if you can identify with someone else's problem, then you're more willing to help them. So for us, we really believe that, you know, that was a blessing in disguise, and we're hoping that, you know, this summer we're doing further testing, research and development. We're doing human testing. We're doing carcinogenic reports on our fabric and disposal reports, because we're planning on selling to governments. And in order to do that, you know, you really have to take things to the next level and educating people.